Please take a seat. We want to get started. Christine, I'm surprised you're here. With all of the emails and phone calls that you've been getting over the last couple of months, and I've contributed to that, you know that, right? And you still like me. Christine, please revise this. Please revise that proposal. Thank you. Anyway, Christine began her career as an antenna design engineer for RCA Antennas. Following a dielectric acquisition, Christine was promoted to antenna product manager and later served as dielectric senior director of sales and marketing. Christine has a Bachelor of Science degree in electrical engineering from Penn State and an MBA from Rutgers University. Christine is a member of the Association of Federal Communications Consulting Engineers and has been a featured speaker on antenna systems design, transmission lines, and filter technology at regional and national SBE conferences. Ladies and gentlemen, Christine Zuba.
Thank you, Kent. Can you hear me okay out there? Okay, thank you. It's very nice to be here with you today. Thank you all for being here this morning. A lot of people have asked me, you must have been very busy over the last 6 months. And certainly between March and June, when people had to get their 399 forms done and their construction permits filed, it was kind of crazy. And this next picture kind of shows you what my life was like. That's me there. It's gotten a little bit better, but with the maximization phase going on right now, it's gotten crazy again. So what I'd like to talk about today is I'm going to talk a little bit about a broadband product that we've developed for the repack. Then I'm going to switch over and talk about filters, six-pole and eight-pole filters, and adjacent channel combining. All keeping into consideration ATSC 3.0. And then I'm going to focus a little bit more on ATSC 3.0 and let you know how we're looking at things on how we design our products and things that we're doing differently to anticipate 3.0 and to design for 3.0 today. When two or more stations want to combine their systems onto one tower, traditionally it's been done one of two different ways. One way is to combine those antennas into a panel antenna over here. Another way would be to physically stack those antennas with one channel above the other, much like you have here in Madison on the candelabra. We've now developed an antenna that is broader than a traditional slot. It's not as broad as the entire UHF spec range, but it's good for about 8 to 10 channels, and I'm going to talk a little bit about that. And that's this antenna right here. A slotted cylinder antenna, and there are a lot of them that are out there right now, as well as broadband type antennas, but a slotted cylinder antenna has a lot of advantages versus a broadband panel. It's much smaller in size. It's less wind load, certainly, on the tower, and it's got less connections and less parts, which means longer term, it's more reliable and less maintenance. The disadvantages of a slotted cylinder antenna is its inherently narrow bandwidth. It's only got about a 1% bandwidth over the entire UHF range. Whereas a panel antenna is typically can be made broad over the entire UHF band. What we found, however, is if you put a dipole over the slot, a vertical element over the slot, it adds a capacitance and tends to broaden that slot slightly. It lowers the Q and increases the bandwidth. The other advantage that a panel antenna has is it has a corporate feed system. So it allows you to distribute the impedances so that it can be broadband. We can do that on a side-mounted type antenna to a certain extent, where we, instead of having individual slots. We will have groups of 4 or 8 slots sectionalized, and then feed them from a corporate power divider and feed each of these sections. So we can broaden a site mount antenna in that fashion. And doing it that way, we can typically get around 9.5% bandwidth, about 8 to 10 channels. But this is a side mount type design. How can we do this in a top mounted type slotted cylinder? One of the things that we've done over the last few years at Dielectric is we've invested very heavily in a process called HFSS, high frequency simulation software. And what we've been using that for years now on our components, transitions, transformers, individual parts, and we can go from design to manufacture to test very fast with very little changes. In the old days, we used to design it, it'd get built, and then you'd send it to the test lab and it'd get tweaked for 2 weeks. HFSS allows us to do things much faster and much more accurately. In the last year and a half, we started applying HFSS to slotted cylinder and antenna designs and panel designs as well. And it's allowed us to come up with new designs and ideas that previously we were not able to. Many of you are familiar with our center-fed type antennas, where the electrical feed point is in the center of a top mount. Top mount antenna. So physically the antenna is fed at the bottom, but it has a piece of transmission line running up inside the steel pipe. And what happens at the center point is the power is split and it goes upwards and downwards along the outer conductor of the transmission line, which becomes the inner conductor of the antenna pole transmission line combination. So the signals then transfer upwards and downwards from the center point. This gives you a very stable impedance, a very stable elevation pattern. So what we've done using HFSS is we've developed a 20-layer broadband antenna where we physically take two of these and stack them on top of each other. So we have a 5-5 in the lower part and a 5-over-5 in the upper part. And to date, we've designed this only as an omnidirectional high power type antenna, as an alternative where you may have channels that are spaced 10 channels or less apart in the same market. Again, it's only omni at this point, but we're constantly doing different things and changing designs and upgrades, so it may become directional at some point in the future as well. But the feed to the, there's a power divider here, and the feed to the antenna up at the top runs outside the lower portion and then back in here to the upper antenna. The elevation gain is fairly stable across 8 to 10 channels. It varies a little bit, about plus or minus a dB and a quarter. The beam tilt is very stable as well. And the elevation pattern, as you can see, it varies a little bit, but again, it's pretty good over 80 or so megahertz. And the VSWR looks pretty good over 8 channels, less than a 112, and I'm sure if I twisted John Shadler's arm a little bit, we could broaden that out a little bit more. In terms of patterns, again, this is an omni. So what you have, because you have the feed line running through the lower portion of the antenna, you have a little bit of a distortion, and that effect is more prominent on the vertical component, which is the blue line. Because this line is vertical, it does affect the vertical component more so. But the circularity is still pretty reasonable. For the H pole, it's plus or minus a dB, and for the V pole, it's plus or minus 3 dB, which is not too bad. Now I'm going to move over to filters. for ATSC 1 and ATSC 3. For ATSC 3, we know the PAPR is going to be a little bit higher than it is for ATSC 1, somewhere in the order of 2 to 3 dB higher. For a while, that number was unknown, was thought to be as high as 10 to 12 dB for 3.0 or even higher, which was kind of scary to us on the manufacturing side. But it looks like that's going to end up being around 8 to 9 dB. The bandwidth is going to be wider by about 500 kilohertz for 3.0 versus 1.0. And because broadcasters will be employing vertical polarization for portable type devices, vertical component will need more power. So that has to be considered on top of everything else, not only on the filter side, but on the antenna side as well. Some of our engineers are kind of have a weird sense of humor. The response for a six-pole filter will work for 3.0 as well. The shoulders should be able to be made to work with a six-pole filter because the transmitters can handle that. This is the, again, the response of the six-pole filter. And again, because of solid-state transmitters, a six-pole filter will work just fine. This is a plot of the rejection mask versus a six-pole response versus an eight-pole response. And what you can see is the eight-pole is the orange line. The 8-pole gives you roughly 18 dB more rejection to the adjacent channel. Or to the contrary, the 6-pole filter is emitting 18 dB more noise than the 8-pole filter does into that adjacent channel. And that's the important thing to consider here. Where this really comes into play is where you have adjacent channels that are not co-located and that have significantly different ERPs. And the high power station has a 6-pole filter. What this particular example shows, a low power station roughly 25 miles from a high power station that is using a 6-pole filter. And what you have is a radius of interference that is roughly 5 miles around that low power station. Now, if that high power station employs an 8-pole filter, that radius of interference is decreased significantly. So if you are a station right now that is not being repacked and you have a 6-pole filter, it'll be fine for 3.0. The problem may be with any low powers that are repacked and become adjacent to you, you may be causing some interference to them, and I'm not sure how the FCC will get involved with that down the road. Now, in terms of combining adjacent channels, what you're going to have are combiners that look very much like the mask filters that were originally developed for DTV before solid state. You'll have a constant impedance type filter, whether it's this type right here, or whether it's a directional type filter, which is a little bit different design, has a little different characteristics. But it'll be a pair of 8-pole filters with hybrids at each end, with the one channel coming in from one end and the other channel coming in from the other end by the output port. For VHF, it's much the same thing, except the size and the physical differences and the way they look. In the upper left is a high VHF adjacent channel combiner, and the sketch down below is an adjacent channel low band type. They're quite large. Now, the difference between 1.0 and 3.0 in the adjacent channel combining is that the guard band between the channels at 1.0 was 620 kilohertz. That guard band, because the bandwidth is wider now at 3.0, that guard band is now reduced to 160 kilohertz. So that's an additional challenge for us. So what you have, when you have adjacent channel combining, you'll have a roll-off that occurs at the band edges that has to be taken into consideration. Additionally, what you have is a higher group delay with the eight-pole adjacent channel combiners. And today's solid-state transmitters can handle this group delay easily, so that's really not a problem, but it is higher. The thing we have to worry about is what happens inside those cavities with the adjacent channel combiner. Typically, if you put 1 volt in, the voltages multiply very fast inside those cavities. So if you put 1 volt in, you can have up to 23 volts at the band edge. So it usually, at the end of the cavity, at the band edge. So what we have to do is we have to look at those last couple of cavities very closely. In addition, because of that band roll-off, the transmitter will want to pre-correct, pushing more power and more energy on those band edges. So we have to consider that as well. And again, where this occurs really is at the end of those filter modules in resonators 7 and 8. You get a lot of stored energy at those locations that we have to take a look at. This is an example using HFSS for heat analysis of resonators 7 and 8 in an adjacent channel combiner, two stations, 40 kilowatts each, using a half-wave type cavities, which are very common. In this case, all we're doing is applying channel 19 at one channel at 40 kilowatts. You can see there is some heating around the probes, but it's in the blue area, so it's not really too bad. But if we apply the second channel, the adjacent channel, as well, what happens is you get a tremendous amount of heat at those probes. So that's a problem for us and for you as well. So how do we correct for this? How do we get around this problem? It turns out if we go to a full wave type cavity for those last two resonators, we can eliminate the heating issue and get a 2-to-1 improvement in voltage safety factor. So this is how that filter would look. For the first six resonators, you'd have half wave type cavities, and for the last two would be a full wave type cavity to minimize this heating and this voltage buildup. We can also get around this by using a waveguide type filter. It's something that we've had in development for a long time because power levels keep getting pushed higher and higher. So we continue to work on this type of filter. The thing that the waveguide filter gives you 2 degrees of tuning. Not only do you have the tuning probes that you have in the cylindrical type cavity, but you also have paddles in the sides that you can use to tune the cavities themselves. So you can mitigate and reduce the heating that occurs on the probes themselves. So on the filter part of this, six-pole filters, if you have them now, they will meet the 3.0 mask. Eight-pole filters will be good to employ if there are adjacent channels in your market or if you're moving to repacking to a new channel that you know there will be adjacents in your market. It's probably a good thing to purchase an eight-pole filter now. And in terms of combining, we have to be very careful about heating in the adjacent channel combiners, and we have means to get around that. Okay, now moving on to antennas for 3.0 and for the higher PAPR. I'm not sure if John Shadler last year, if he talked about our future fill concept in his presentation here, but what we're doing for every antenna that we ship now, we're building this concept and this ability into those antennas, whether it be a slotted cylinder or a panel. A lot of people in the industry believe that for 3.0, for the higher data rate services, the ability to receive those services in the home or in difficult to receive locations will be dependent upon signal strength. That you will need more signal strength with 3.0 for those higher data rate services than you might need for 1.0. So if in order to design and build today for that possible configuration or need, what we're doing is designing the ability to increase null fill into the antennas without having to take those antennas down. And basically what we're doing is at certain locations in the antennas, whether it's a slotted cylinder antenna or a panel, we have the ability to change the phase at that slot location by 180 degrees by moving the couplers to the other side of the slot. And what that does is it can increase your close-in null fill by 7 to 10 dB. Now, there's no free lunch. So what happens when you do that is you lose a maximum of 1 to 2 dB in the main beam. So you lose a little bit out at the fringe areas here. But for 3.0, the thought is that for these higher data rate services, what you will need in addition to the big stick is these single frequency networks scattered throughout your coverage area as well. So if that is the case, and you end up redoing your system for higher data rate services requiring more null fill, they will be supplemented by single frequency networks to offset any coverage loss that you would get from doing this. So every antenna that's going out, the first one we did was about 9 months ago to KPPX in Phoenix. It had this built into it. And what we're doing is we're testing it that way at the factory before it goes out the door to make sure this concept works. And all it takes is about two riggers, maybe a day, to go up there and open the radome and flip the couplers over, and you can increase your null fill. It has absolutely no effect on the input VSWR of the antenna. Now, we know for 3.0, PAPR is going to be higher. So the first thing as an antenna manufacturer we have to decide is, what's it going to be? Does it affect us? And if it does affect us, how do we fix it? How do we design for it? So we spent a lot of time doing this analysis, trying to figure out what the PAPR is going to be and so forth. It seems like it's going to be somewhere around 8 versus 6 today. The ATSC 3.0 standard has techniques within it for clipping or PAPR reduction techniques. But what we're finding is that most manufacturers are going to come up with their, transmitter manufacturers are going to have their own proprietary techniques for clipping and reducing that PAPR. This is a plot courtesy of one of the transmitter manufacturers. And what this is showing you is that they are able, with their clipping techniques, this is a plot of PAPR versus bit error rate. And so what marker 4 is showing you down here is that they have achieved a PAPR of 7.8 dB with a bit error rate of 0.001%. So that's quite good. So as we say, we're going to use, for the most part, 8 to 9 dB in our calculations for PAPR. Now, OFDM is all about probability and statistics, and this was not one of my favorite subjects in college. It's also a part of the presentation that I refer to as nap time, because it gets pretty intense. But it's something that we have to analyze. If, for example, we clip the signal levels to 6 dB, what we have to look at is the chance that all these carriers in the OFDM signal will add up in phase at their maximum amplitude. And that's where the damage can be done. So if we clip those signals at 6 dB, the probability of an occurrence is 5.9 times 10 to the 7 seconds a year, which, if you do the math, it's twice in a year's time. So that's quite a bit, so we have to be concerned about that. So again, this is, if we know the probability of one station is 0.0187, if we have two stations involved, the total probability is one station times the probability of the other station. So what we're designing for in terms of safety margin for PAPR is we're designing such that there's a probability of one event in 100 years, not two events in a year, one event in 100 years, and that's our goal when we design. Now, when we get involved with multiple stations, this is a plot of events in a 100-year period versus the number of stations looking at various PAPRs. And if we use the PAPR of 9, we could see that this one event in 100 years occurs when we have roughly 3 stations involved. If we have more than 3 stations involved, the probability goes down. So that means typically if we have more than three stations combined, we don't have to worry about it because probability goes down. We really have to look at things when we have 2 stations or 3 stations. In terms of voltage breakdown, it's all dependent on pulse width. And there is such a thing called the critical pulse width, and it's dependent on pressure. And at sea level, that critical pulse width turns out to be 1.315 microseconds. So in a moment, we're going to compare that to the pulse width at 3.0. But what this chart is showing you, that if we plot voltage breakdown versus pulse width, that critical pulse width falls on this chart right here, this voltage breakdown curve, at a voltage breakdown of roughly 22.8 kilovolts per centimeter. So what this chart is showing you is that if the pulse width is narrower, narrower pulse widths need more voltage to induce breakdown. So if for 3.0, if the pulse width is narrower, you need more voltage to break down the slot, the coupling at the slot, which is a good thing because it's more than the critical pulse, critical pulse width. If the pulse width at 3.0 is on this side of the critical pulse width, there's not much we can do about it. Well, the pulse length is a function of bandwidth and the number of subcarriers in the OFDM signal. So, and it turns out that for 3.0, the critical pulse width is between 0.17 and 0.18 microseconds, which means it falls to the left of that critical pulse width. So what this is telling us is that the voltage breakdown at 3.0 needed is 27.5 kilovolts per centimeter, which is 20% higher than 1.0. So we could take advantage of this in our designs and our safety factors. This chart just plots the voltage rating factor, where we talked about one station being 20%. If we have two stations, three stations, four stations, because the pulse widths get smaller as you add more stations, more channels, the voltage required to break down is more, so we can use this factor to our advantage. What works against us, however, in antenna designs is VSWR. And depending on the type of antenna that we're designing, and we have various types, the VSWR internal to the antenna, not the complete antenna, but individually at various places within the antenna, can vary from 1.2 to 1.3, or even as high as 2 to 1. So again, this works against us. What also works against us is that we have to take into consideration is the antennas are subject to the elements, corrosion, and aging. So all this has to go into whatever safety factor we develop. So if we apply the voltage safety factor and the VSWR, which works negatively against us, our criteria internally for a safety factor on an antenna is 5 to 1, which sounds high, but given the fact that these antennas are outdoors and subject to the elements environment, we want to make sure that you don't have any problems going forward. So let's take a look at what goes on inside of an antenna. So now that we know that we have a safety margin, a safety factor for 3.0, how do we get there? Okay. The fields inside of a coaxial type slotted cylinder antenna look like this. And what happens is we as manufacturers put a coupling element inside this pipe. It could be a bar, a round bar, could be a probe type, or could be a square type bar, depending on the manufacturer. We use this cylindrical type of bar. And what this does is interrupt the fields and creates a potential across this slot. And then current then flows around the circumference of the antenna, and that creates your horizontal polarization. So the electric fields and the analysis of these electric fields is all based upon geometry, has to do with shapes and distances. And the one thing we have to be careful of is the distance between the coupler itself and the inner conductor. So the size of this element is critical. What we have found, however, is in the antenna couplers themselves, if we were to double the radius of that coupler that sits inside that slot, we can get a 3 dB increase in PAPR. The problem is if you double the coupling, the radius on that coupler, you're going to shorten the distance between that coupler and the inner conductor, which is not what you want to do. However, what we've done, and we're doing this on all of our antenna designs that are going out the door for the repack, is we basically doubled the radius, or doubled the size of that coupler, but we've cut it in half so that this distance here remains the same as it was. So we can get the increase in voltage handling capability and safety factor rating in this type of fashion. So as I said, we're doing this with every antenna that's going out the door for the repack. Let's take a look for a second at panel antennas. And we build panel antennas that are broadband over the entire UHF range as well. Those antennas typically use two types of feed systems, a coaxial type feed system and a strip line type feed. We use both, but we typically use the strip line type feed system on lower power type systems. The strip line type, you can see here the strip line type feed systems, you'll have more heating because you have some sharper edges. If you use a coaxial type feed system, you have much less heating and the electrical fields are much lower. What we've also found too is that if you pressurize, if you increase the pressure to 5 psi, you could lower the voltage breakdown by 1.13, by 13%. And so that's what we're doing as well. Now, if you combine the two, if you use a coaxial type feed system and you pressurize, we can increase the voltage safety factor by 50%. And this translates to an increase in PAPR rating of 3.5 dB, which is significant. So to conclude, 3.0 requires us to look at things in a whole new way in terms of designs versus 1.0. When we design to be 3.0 ready, geometry is the key. No sharp edges. We're dealing with shapes and distances. And to paraphrase this last line about test, analysis, and experience, paraphrasing a commercial that's out there a lot these days, we know a thing or two because we've seen a thing or two. Thank you. Any questions? Yes, Gary.
Excellent presentation.
Thank you.
One of the best. Question, broadband antennas, how is the gain affected compared to a single channel?
Typically with broadband antennas, the gain's a little bit lower. It's certainly gonna vary what frequency. Are you talking about panels?
Either one.
Typically the gain's a little bit lower because what you have, you have elements that are fixed in spacing, so that spacing looks different in terms of wavelengths from a lower channel to a higher channel, where a single antenna, a slotted cylinder antenna, those slots are spaced as a function of wavelength for that channel, so you can get more gain out of it.
Like how many dB? What are we talking?
1 to 2 dB.
Okay.
Yeah.
There, you've spoken quite a bit about UHF. Are there any significant differences at high VHF?
Well, the one good thing is the powers are a lot lower. That's for sure. But we're analyzing those as well the same way we are with UHF. Every antenna design that we propose, even in a proposal stage where we give you a technical spec before it's sold, when you're still doing your analysis, and making your decisions on what you're going to buy, before they go out the door, they're looked at by engineering. Are they ready for 3.0?
Thank you. Great presentation, Christine. As a manufacturer, do you feel that you'll be able to keep up with the demand of the construction phases as they're laid out in the public notice? And are you also seeing enough orders now that that are trying to get a head start?
You know, I'm not going to say no. But no, we will not be the bottleneck in this thing. We've opened a new plant. We've expanded our capacity. So we've said right along, and our corporate has given us the resources to do what we need to do to crank out what we have to do in 3 years. We've got orders for over 100 antennas already for all various phases. And we plan to have those antennas built months before the start of your testing phase. So whether they go in storage or they give you a window to do your installation, we believe we will not be the bottleneck in this. I think unfortunately, the construction side might be the bottleneck in this whole thing, and weather. But no, we're ready to roll, and we are rolling. I got out from under all that paper.
In the dual-fed UHF pylon, multi-channel, is there only one fine matcher? And if you have a failure in half of the antenna, can you break the power divider below the stack and then just feed one half and limp along if something were to occur?
The answer to your second question is yes. The answer to your first question would be one, because the antenna would be physically put together in the factory, and that line going through the lower portion would probably be match marked, so everything is exactly the same when you get it into the field. In fact, it may be shipped, it probably would be shipped altogether as one anyway, as it was tested, so it'd just be one. Okay, thank you very much, appreciate it.